We are recording in public session.
Okay, the time is 8:33 on April 20th, 2021, and I'm convening this video conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, Governor Abbott's suspension of certain Open Meeting Act requirements due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on April 9th, 2021 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as 7 of the 8 appointed directors have been confirmed as attending by video or audio conference. Director Huckabee has a conflict and is unable to attend, while one director position remains vacant. Also in attendance are Bhakti Patel of Clifton Larson Allen, Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Association employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from the Texas Department of Insurance, we have John Alexander, John Peters, James Kennedy, Brian Wiebe, Patty Otto, and Caitlin Merrick. And first up, we have consideration and possible action on consent agenda items. The official minutes of the prior meeting and ratification of NOLGA's fees and expense billing for fourth quarter of 2020. Do I have
a motion? Mr. Jean, I'll move approval.
Jim Harrison seconds.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the consent agenda passed. And now we're on to agenda item 2, Texas Department of Insurance.
Yes, thanks, Jim. Good morning, everyone. Just a couple of things that I thought I'd pass along at TDI. We continue to work under our existing telework arrangements. There's been no new announcements as to just when that might change. However, we did hear, I guess it was last week, that the DWC, the Division of Workers' Comp, is making some arrangements to return to the office. They have in-person hearings that will need to begin occurring again. So that was the latest news on that, but no change for us at Hobby. And then the second one I just passed along is, interestingly, we just completed last week the spring a national meeting of NAIC that was held virtually. And so a number of us participated remotely on that virtual meeting, and it wrapped up at the end of last week. Those were the two announcements I had this morning. Thank you.
Jim, you are muted.
Hello, sorry. Item 3 on the agenda is the financial, the audit committee. So Dean, you're up.
Yeah, you all should have a packet marked confidential. And inside there, you'll find the audit and some letters to management. Balky, could you take us through these things?
Yes. First off, thank you for the opportunity to present the results of the audit today. As Dean mentioned, my name is Bhakti Patel. I'm the audit principal with Clifton Larson Allen, CLA, and the engagement principal for the association's audit. CLA performed the independent financial statement audit of the association for the fiscal year ended December 31st, 2020. We presented the detailed results of that audit and made required communications to the association's audit committee on April 7th. So today, I'd just like to take a few minutes to present the overall results of that audit. We've already presented the detailed results, so just want to high level present those results today. Overall, CLA is issuing an unmodified opinion over the association's financial statements for the year ended December 31, 2020. In other words, a clean opinion. This is the highest level of assurance that an independent auditor can give, so which is what we will be issuing this year. A couple of other things during our audit, we may come across audit adjustments that management may elect to make or pass on if not material in the financial statements. We did not have any proposed audit adjustments this year as part of our audit that were made by management or passed on. We also review management's internal control over financial reporting as part of our audit and are required to communicate any control deficiencies that we deem warrant the attention of those charged with governance. This year's audit, we did not identify any deficiencies that met this criteria. In fact, we did not identify any deficiencies in internal control that we deemed to be lesser in severity during our audit, which we would normally just communicate to management. So no deficiencies identified in this year's audit. So overall, management provided complete and accurate financial statements to us. We did not have any difficulty performing the audit this year. And that's really it. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Okay, thank you, Bhakti. And Jim, there is a proposed resolution. I will move it up screen here. There's two on this page. The first one has to do with the 2020 financial audit that was just summarized by Bhakti.
Before we go there, Bhakti, could you hit the high points of the numbers for us?
Sure. Let me pull
the... So Bhakti, do you want me to give you access? Do you want to show anything on screen?
Yes. Let me pull the financial statements. One moment, Bart.
Okay.
Is the presentation to the audit committee still on the Dropbox? Would we be able to present that? There was one slide where I had that information, which we can pull from.
Yes, it's still up there. If you want to pull that real quick, and I will...
Please. That's probably the easiest to run through quickly. I can pull it up if easier.
Are you going to pull it, Bhakti, or do you want me to do it? And I will give you permission.
Okay. I am pulling it up now. My apologies, did not have this up.
And when you're ready, you can share directly. I've given you permission.
Okay, it's just...
Bhakti, overall, what would you say about the financial condition of the association?
The financial condition is healthy. No significant insolvencies this year. Overall net position looks good. So I would say it's a healthy financial position at the end of December 31, 2020. I will go over a few of the highlights here also that we discussed at the audit committee meeting. So let's share my screen now. I think I have it up now. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay. So these are just some highlights of the financial statements. I believe they were in the board packet. So overall, some of the larger swings in numbers that we saw this year, cash and cash equivalents did decrease $9.5 million, but that was primarily as a result of investments that were purchased in the current year. So it was about $10.6 million of US Treasuries purchased. So that decrease in cash essentially converted to an increase in the investments for the association. Unbilled assessments increased about $1.4 million, primarily due to two items in fiscal 20. One was a Kalente Mutual insolvency, which was about $1.1 million. It was a new insolvency this year. And then some administrative costs related to SHIP, which is not an insolvency yet, but there were some administrative costs related to that, which were about $160,000. So Everything else stayed pretty much the same over year, except for these two items, which caused a little bit of a swing. And these two items were zero in the prior year. And so new situations this year that caused that amount to swing. Moving on to the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position, we saw the build assessments increase $2.3 million, and that was due to the Class A assessment that was approved by the board. So we did see the swing in that number. The change in unbilled assessments, related to the unbilled assessments on the balance sheet there in the statement of net position. So we saw that increase about $1 million due to the same two items that I discussed before, the Kelly and Thayer Mutual insolvency that was new in fiscal 20, as well as some of this administrative cost fund shift that we saw this year. One other swing we saw on the statement of revenues that we felt we needed to communicate, National Task Force expenses decreased about $1.4 million, primarily related to fewer expenses related to the Lincoln Memorial litigation administered by NOLGA. So those year over year have been decreasing. We've seen a pretty significant decrease of those expenses year over year. So saw that decrease happening again this year. Some significant footnotes and all of these items that I mentioned in our statement of net position, statement of revenues, we have detailed footnotes in there as well regarding why these things happen, whether it's in the management discussion analysis or the footnotes to the financial statements. But some of the more significant footnotes for the association's financial statements that we take a little bit more time on to look at to ensure that they are correct and accurate. Note five is the membership assessment. Obviously, this was a larger transaction this year, the $2.3 million assessment. So that has been disclosed in note five. Note six are the proof of claims. There are still about $601 million of claims receivable. And this number tends to stay pretty standard for year to year. It is 100% allowed for. So on the financials, we'll see zero, but we see the breakdown of the gross amount and the net amount in the footnote for transparency. Note nine is our insurance contractual obligations. We have about $4 million of estimated future cash payments for impaired or insolvent companies. And that is disclosed in note nine. And then note 15, it's a lengthier footnote, but it goes through all of the commitments and contingencies the association has. Some additional discussion over Penn Treaty and Lincoln Memorial, those being the larger insolvencies that have been carried year over year. And then some other subject to recovery, subject to return, and ongoing claims that the association administers. So a lengthy note 15 to provide some transparency on the larger insolvencies and all of the other insolvencies. So those are the big things that happen. As I mentioned earlier, the financial health of the association is still healthy. The net position is still a strong balance. And management continues to watch these insolvencies and ensure it's still liquid enough to cover these.
Thank you, Baki. Was there any difficulties in the audit?
No, sir. No difficulties. Management provided all of the information that we requested timely, accurately. We did perform the audit remotely this year, 100% remotely, which was the first time we did that, but that went fine. Management was able to provide everything electronically. We were able to jump on Zoom meetings and team meetings to get any questions answered. So that went very smoothly.
Thank you. Yeah, now I think we can entertain that resolution you had, Bart.
Okay. I will flip back around. Give me just a moment. Here we go. It'll be the one here at the top of the page.
Yeah, I move we accept the audit report.
Jim Harrison seconds.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Okay, motion passed.
And Bhakti, thank you very much. And I'll say we will see you later because I know you have other clients.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time today, everyone. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, Bhakti.
All right, Dean, back to you.
Yeah, I think we wanted to talk about the implementation of GASB 87 It involves capitalization of, I guess, virtually all leases. And the gotcha in there is what discount rate to use to bring the lease payments back to present value. So Jarrett was thinking we need a little help, and we'd like to hire a different branch of Clifton Larson to help us with the implementation of GASB 87. It's a different branch of the company, so they won't be auditing their own work.
So these consulting services should provide three things, and you may have read this in the proposal we sent confidentially to the board with respect to the implementation of GASB 87. The team, should we let this engagement, will prepare lease asset schedules. And I believe, Jarrett, there are three leases involved here. They will also propose journal entries to implement this accounting standard, and then prepare draft footnotes to explain the new items on that are presented in the financials. You will see later in the financials, I believe it's under item 12, Jarrett has prepared some financials that as of January 31st reflects what we think these new items will be, and we have numbers in there that are preliminary. They're going to be subject to review after we do this work with Clifton Larson Allen. So the implementation we're talking about would take effect 1/1/21. So it would be for this entire year. And first, I guess I'll just entertain any questions you have about the proposal we submitted to you.
Yeah, what was the fee estimate?
$2,620.
Bart, I would like to throw out one more thing.
Sure.
We talked about this because Dean raised the concern about Clifton Larson doing something and then auditing their own work. We posed that question to Bhakti in our exit interview, and she assured us that they go through a pretty detailed analysis to ensure that they're not violating any auditing standards before they even offer these types of services. So she assured us that there would be a separation of duty and that they would not be auditing their own work. And like Dean said, it would be a separate department of Clifton Larson Allen that performs this.
Yeah, questions? I think that's a pretty reasonable fee, and it looks like we get some important deliverables. So I would recommend the second resolution that we hire the branch of Clifton Larson to help us with GASB 87 implementation.
Jim Harrison, so moved.
Ted Kennedy, second.
Any discussion? Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Thank you very much.
And Dean, if I could throw in there, the only other things that the audit committee addressed based on the results of the 2020 audit, they did look at the 2021 audit plan to see if there would be any necessity for revision. And they felt there was no need to revise that plan. And then in its charter, the audit committee has that it will look at network penetration testing every other year, with the next time that is due would be this year. But with the conversion to a cloud environment that the association has been undergoing, actually was just completed this past weekend, we will be implementing some changes, and there's different equipments and different access points. And then with the office move at the end of May, we had asked that the committee postpone that testing until we're under the new operating environment. So we are testing something that's going to be in place rather than testing something that's about to be rendered moot. So the committee approved that postponement and asked that we gather proposals for network penetration testing and bring to them in their October 18th meeting. And Dean, I believe that was all from the audit committee.
When will we have the engagement resolution on the agenda?
Excuse me, I say that again, Dean. I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
When will we have the resolution to engage Clifton Garson for another year on the audit?
They will provide a proposal to us in the fall, so it will be on the agenda for your October 18th meeting.
Okay, thank you.
And Jim, I believe that's the end of the audit committee's report.
Okay. We'll move on to item number four then, corporate governance committee.
That's me, Mr. Chair. Ready for me to proceed?
Yeah, you're up.
Perfect. So the Corporate Governance Committee met on March 24th and continued and indeed completed its discussion of its delineated four charges, resulting in the submission to the board this day, three resolutions. As a reminder, this committee was created to look at four things. First, the training of new board of directors. Second, the access to counsel, both councils. Third, the evaluation of those councils. And fourth, how we go about soliciting bids for contracted services. So with those four targets in mind, and I think maybe what I'll do is introduce the discussion by introducing and the resolutions themselves and then back our way into the discussion. So I'll refer you to page 4-2, the first of the three resolutions entitled Initial Orientation and Ongoing Training of the Board of Directors. This resolution includes four stipulated recommendations and two further resolutions. The first two of those affect new board members. One is the introduction in the introductory packet and through a live orientation of a slide packet that you should have before you. We're going to go through that, but those identify duties to describe board counsel and general counsel and provide access information. The intention through this resolution is that these slides be adopted, and then under item two for new board members, that those board members be given a live orientation, which would include participation from the board counsel and general counsel who would present on this new material. And under items three and four for board participation, there would be an annual refresher of this information. And fourthly, a creation of a portal so that all information with respect to board participation, board duties and responsibilities and other information would be readily accessible at any time for board reference. And finally, under that resolution, we would propose to the board that on an annual basis, the board be given a refresher of sorts, a notice that the board counsel and general counsel contact information, direct information be provided once again, at least on an annual basis at a board meeting, to remind everyone of their responsibilities, duties, and access. And then finally, a proposal that we have Bart reach out to TDI and perhaps prepare one or two slides to be added to this board packet of information, summarizing the roles of TDI in respect to the association. So before I move on to the other two resolutions, I thought perhaps we would have some discussion over this one, and particularly Bart, if you'd like to walk us through the slides that have been prepared.
Right. And what I've done is I'm not put the full board of director orientation packet on here. Just the new slides that the committee developed, actually were developed and provided by both Shelby Betts as board counsel and Jackie Rickson as general counsel. And then the committee did recommend them. So there are two slides, and it's a little hard to make them fit on screen. Hope you can see that. Two slides discussing the fiduciary duties of a director of the association. And Shelby, is there anything there you want to specifically point out? First, I want to say this, Shelby, in all the boards I've served on and the other materials I've seen prepared for guarantee associations, this is the best summary of fiduciary obligations of a director that I've ever seen. So I appreciate you pulling this together. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. It's a lot of material on the slide. It's a little dense for a slide, but it's just important to express at the at the beginning orientation for directors, what your fiduciary duties are, what's stated in the act, and what are some common law duties. So we will, this hasn't really been hit hard in prior orientations. And I think now there's going to be ample training on this. So I don't think we need to go over the details today.
Okay.
But it'll be, I think what as Bart said, he hasn't given you the entire deck, but it'll be a great resource for directors to deliverable to take with them after the orientation. I think there's a lot of information that you'll be able to refer to throughout your tenure as directors.
And as Ted mentioned, for these two slides on the duties, or there's actually three slides on the fiduciary duties of the board, when that orientation is held with the new director, which I conduct, I will ask that Shelby attend as board counsel and present this information rather than me try to explain it. Shelby will directly present it and answer any questions a new director might have about their fiduciary obligations. And then there's also, I'll move to the next slide, which is a description of the duties of board counsel. And Shelby assembled this, and it's used actually to compare and contrast the duties. Why have a board counsel? Why have general counsel? There are some overlaps, but there are some distinct differences on the obligations and the duties of the two. And I think it's captured pretty well in these slides. Ted, is there any reason you'd like for me to get into detail on this slide?
I don't believe so, unless board members have questions.
Okay. And Shelby, anything here you want to point out before I flip to the next one?
No. As you just said, I think it's good to have that laid out, and you can compare and contrast it with the duties of Jackie, which are much broader.
And Ms. Rickson, here's the slide that describes the duties of general counsel. And I'm sorry, it is difficult sometimes in screen share to get everything to fit without making it too small. But this material was emailed out to the board in advance of the meeting. Jackie, anything you would like to add?
Nope, I don't think so. I think it's all there, Bart.
Okay, and as I mentioned, Ted, when I do the orientation of a new director, not only will Shelby attend, but I'll ask Jackie to attend and explain these duties as well. And the last thing that will be in the packet is a new slide that specifically provides all the contact information for both counsel with a comment at the bottom that I think is important. The director should feel free to directly contact either counsel with any questions, concerns, or need for additional information. So we want to make it very, very clear that there's no filtering, there's no channeling of information. If a director has a counsel question for either of the counsel, they should contact them directly.
And Bart, in furtherance of that, I think there was a recognition by the committee that, particularly with respect to public sector members, but any new board members to this association are somewhat drinking out of a fire hose at the onset. They're provided with a plethora of information, a lot of new topics and issues to tackle. So the goal through this resolution is to not only provide good and accurate information as part of the introductory packet and enhance our live orientation with that board member, then, but also an equal balance given to recognition that board members may from time to time want to reference this material, be reminded of that material. So you'll see throughout the resolution a recurrence of this information, a refresher of this information, the portal being created so as to allow board members, perhaps once they've had a period of time to digest the new information, to go back and reference it and brush up on a periodic basis.
Right.
So, and of this, Bart, do you have anything further to describe the rest of the resolution?
The only thing that's not in the resolution the committee did reference was in the third item under that first resolution, the annual refresher to all directors. They suggested that that might be conducted after the review of the self-evaluation responses of the board of directors. That would be in each January board meeting, that after we go through the self-evaluation, that we have a quick refresher on duties and obligations of the directors and some of this orientation material and any questions that the directors might have. So as part of my process, when I send the annual reminder via email to the directors about their obligations, their fiduciary obligations, and their ability to access counsel, I will also solicit any areas that they would like to have specifically added as a focus in this annual refresher. So just a little bit to kind of color the process, should this be adopted.
And Bart, since we have the advantage of TDI in the meeting today, I thought I would get their reaction to the final piece of the resolution, which is your outreach to them, asking if they would help us educate our board members by participating with one or two slides that describe their interaction, their role with respect to insolvencies and engagement with the association. Friends at TDI, does that sound in keeping with your initial solicitation of us?
Hi, this is John. I remember us discussing that, and I do agree that that would be a constructive way to share information about the relationship between TDI and the Guarantee Association. I think I learned that there was something like this in place some time ago, perhaps before I joined the agency, and maybe James would like to say a few comments about that.
Yeah, we did go back and look at some of that. And I think that probably what we would do here is a little bit different. There's some areas we could cover, like board appointments and impairment orders and general receivership process.
Okay. And James, we have some information in our orientation packet now for new directors that talks about the relationship between TDI and kind of gives a high level picture of what is a receivership.
Yeah.
And we'll be glad to share those slides with you. And I think then we can collaborate on what's the best way to present this to make it meaningful, but not overwhelming for a new director.
Right. Cause you know, we certainly don't want our piece of it to, you know, overlap with anything you already have in there. So okay. We probably just need to look at the big picture on this, and certainly would be happy to work with you on those slides.
Perfect. We were hoping for. So, board, hopefully we've introduced you to this resolution. Are there any further questions before I entertain a motion? Hearing none, I'll move adoption of this resolution.
Second.
Was that McCandless's second?
Yes, it's Patty Topping, sorry.
Thank you.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Motion pass.
Perfect. So moving on, a separate charge of the committee, That being the proposals for contracted services, you'll see before you on page 4-3, the second of the three proposed resolutions to the board dealing with proposals for contracted services. You'll identify there, and Bart, I think we modified a bit, but the intent of this resolution is to provide an annual evaluation process to identify the terms of engagement. We determined in the proposal before you today is that we remain at a three-year term for both board counsel and general counsel, but that we stagger those terms, and that to the extent, I guess the final aspect of this resolution is that we don't feel it necessary to undertake every 3 years a full RFQ based on the particular aptitudes of our current counsel, the unique nature and skill set required for this counsel. So our thoughts were that without cause, we wouldn't just as a matter of course undertake every 3 years an RFQ. However, to the extent that we wished to test the waters, or based on identification from existing counsel, identified a need for change, that we would prescribe for ourselves a process in advance of ending term to undertake an RFQ, consider and evaluate other offers, and act on those accordingly. So that's the intent of this resolution. Bart, do you have anything further to describe in this?
No, and what's on screen, Ted, is the slightly revised resolution to clean up a little bit of language that was originally in the packet. So I'll ask everyone, please focus on that resolution on the top of the screen that's being displayed right now.
I'll just offer that the revised version still carries the intent that I just attempted to describe. More form, less substance in terms of the change. Any questions with respect to our determinations in this proposed resolution? If not, I'll entertain a motion to adopt this resolution.
Jim Harrison, so moved.
David Summers, second.
Any discussion? Yes. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you.
Perfect. And the final resolution from the committee to the board, as you recall, we engaged this activity, created this committee at the request of TDI. So in order to put a button on this, the third resolution would provide Bart the charge of reaching out to the TDI, reporting back the fulfillment of this, the undertaking of this committee, fulfillment of our charges, the actions taken as a result of their initial inquiry and request. Any questions with respect to that, Bart? Do you have anything further to add?
Well, I will not reach out to TDI, but I will draft a letter summarizing the work of the committee and the changes that are being implemented, and prepare it for signature by both board chair and Ted, you as corporate governance committee chair. So there will be a communication back to TDI to kind of put a button on it, as you mentioned, but it will be from the two of you.
Understood. I apologize. That's what I meant by outreach. We're going to communicate back to TDI that we heard them, we listened, we responded, and we're resolved in the matter unless they have further questions. So does anyone have any questions with respect to that resolution? If not, I'll entertain a motion to accept.
So moved.
Jim Harrison, second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passed.
So, Mr. Chair, with the adoption of those three resolutions presented from the Corporate Governance Committee, that concludes our section.
Okay. And Chair Lewis, let me report one thing the committee did ask me to check on. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that this committee did an absolutely wonderful job. It was very thorough and diligent, the manner in which they reviewed our corporate governance policies, practices, and documentation. So first, it was a very good review. Second thing, the committee, although it appears its work is completed with respect to the charge that was provided to it as an ad hoc committee, they did not recommend that they be dissolved yet, that they asked me to see, does the plan of operation require that they be dissolved at this point, or can they wait to see if there are additional steps that should be taking while or work for them to do as some of these steps are being implemented. Plan of operation does not address this, but the bylaws of the association does discuss the creation of an ad hoc committee and its purpose, but there is no limitation or time period stated when a committee should be, or an ad hoc committee should be dissolved. So I believe the committee is going to continue in existence for a period of time to monitor implementation of their recommendations. And Ted, is that correct?
Exactly, and thank you for mentioning that, Bart.
Anybody have any questions of the committee? Okay, then we'll move on to item number 5. Engagement of the Employment Council implementation of the reorganization. I think this is Bart.
Yes, Jim, thank you. During its January 26th meeting, the board did authorize me to work with our general counsel, Jackie Rickson, to engage an employment council to review the long-range staffing plan I had reviewed and discussed with the committee confidentially in that January meeting. Jackie and I worked to interview 4 employment council. All 4 were very qualified and experienced in this area of law. Any one of the 4, I think, could have done all in very thorough work that we were seeking. But we did choose Tanya Lucio, Richards Rodriguez, and Skeeth, and she was engaged. And during this engagement, as the work was proceeding, which I will provide some details in executive session for the board, but throughout the process, I had conference calls and emails with both Jim Lewis and Robin Vincent as the personnel committee chair to advise them of the engagement, the evaluation of the long-range staffing plan, and staffing changes as they were being implemented. So I think that is a sufficient summary of an overview of this topic, Jim, for public session, and I will have details to discuss in confidential executive session. Unless, Jackie, there was something there that you needed to add that I may have missed?
Nope, I don't think so, Bart.
Okay, then I guess it's time to move on to executive session. So the time is 9:16 a.m. on April 20th, 2021. And I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the board to meet an executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act.
We are recording again in public session.
The time is 10:21 on April 20th, 2021. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And I guess we're on to agenda item number 7. The Southland National resolutions.
Yes, these are the resolutions that were discussed in detail in executive session.
Do I have a motion?
So moved, Ted.
Patty seconds.
Does anybody need further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, thank you. The resolution's passed. And I guess item 8 on the agenda, quarterly report from the executive director.
Okay, Jim, just a few things for me to update everyone. We still have a board of director vacancy, a small company representative after Ms. Carson left the board last September. That vacancy is for a seat that an appointment that will expire September 30th, 2025. I've had some discussions with the Department of Insurance team on this, and I believe there is somewhat of a preference to try to identify an HMO representative to serve in that seat. And so they have asked that if any of the insurance company representatives through your contacts in the industry may know of some HMO representatives that would have interest, please ask them to contact Caitlin Merrick at the TDI. And if you need Caitlin's email address, I'll be glad to provide it. But TDI, it's not like they're doing nothing. They are working to try to fill this vacancy, but would like to obtain some more names and opportunities.
What's the qualification to be considered small?
Outside of the top 50 riders based on premium volume in Texas.
Oh, okay. We have any idea how to ride it in Texas?
It's going to have to be, Jim, one of the hospital district Medicaid MCOs that also does exchange business probably. Otherwise, everybody else is going to be too big. And all the exchange individual market is HMO, commercial HMO, which would be subject to assessment. So I know THP has been reaching out to members, but they're in the middle of session. But I'm going to email them again and give them Caitlin's email. And I may reach out. I mean, Memorial Hermann, Baylor Scott & White. Baylor Scott & White might be too big, but Community First, Community Health Choice in Houston. There's quite a few. I think Parkland does exchange. I need to go look, but there's probably 4 or 5 potential small HMOs that would be suited for this board position. So I'm going to bug them again about it and say, can we just maybe I'll join one of the meetings and make a plea and say how much fun it is and how fantastic BART is and it's a great learning experience and you get to go to NOLGA meetings. And,
And Patty, if you talk with them and they want to talk a little bit about what's involved, they can always call and chat with me. I'll be glad to talk to anyone.
I think I need to make a personal plea. I'll do it and see if we can find somebody.
And this is Caitlin. If anyone is interested and they have questions about the application process or just anything with regards to that, I'm totally happy to take a phone call or email back and forth with them to get them through the process there of applying. So always available.
That's great. Thanks, Caitlin.
Is there any sense of how long we'll leave it vacant before we give up and take someone who wants to be on it? No,
I think it's my understanding, and perhaps John Alexander can chime in if I'm completely off base here, but it's my understanding that as long as we appoint someone within the time period prior to when the vacancy expires in 2025, that person would continue to serve out that term and then at that time in 2025 be eligible to be considered for reappointment. That's my understanding. Did I get that correct, John?
I agree.
So we'd possibly leave it void, leave it open for 4 years just because we can't find a health insurer?
I don't know about that. I'm more optimistic. We'll find someone.
Yeah, okay. I don't think that it's that we're leaving it as a vacancy. I just think the way that the structure of how we have to do the appointments in statute and et cetera, means that person would continue to serve out the remaining term.
Okay. Well, yeah, I wasn't questioning whether or not they'd be, I was just questioning how long we're going to wait to get a volunteer. I know we have life insurers that volunteered to be on it. I know we prefer to have an HMO, but.
And we have done outreach. I am definitely ready to press go on getting someone, you know, appointed and working internally with our staff, you know, to make that process as quick and as seamless as possible. We have been doing the outreach. We just don't have any applications at this point to really take any action at this time, unfortunately.
You mean HMO applications, right?
We don't have any applicants in total at this time.
Okay. Well, I know y'all had one, but told him no, that you were trying to get an HMO.
That was way back in time when we had him as an applicant, and we had we also had Wendy Karsten, and we appointed Wendy Karsten
okay.
at the time. So that was okay. back when we had to choose.
Okay.
So if anyone has any
I'm not trying to be argumentative about it. I'm only asking because I don't know any HMO people, but if you want small company representatives, I can find somebody. I just don't want to do it and string them along like what happened last time. And if it's really only going to be filled by an HMO.
And John, you can also chime in if you think that I'm off base, but it's my understanding from reading the statute is that it's preferable to have an HMO to help round out the board, but it's not a requirement.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think we're going to continue to work on that preference and see where that leads us to.
Okay. Well, then I won't recommend anybody.
Right. This is Patty. I will say that I know United has been pushing for seat for, they would not be a small HMO at all, but if we need another health insurer, I know that's been a big national push for them, and they would probably likely have a candidate, if not having one pending at TDI already.
I don't know that we have a seat small enough for them.
We have to bump somebody out because this is a small company seat.
Right. I'll make another pitch at THP.
Good.
Thank you. However I can help y'all. Thank you so much. Really appreciate everything y'all are doing.
Okay, so moving on, it looks like there still is another vacancy. Commissioner of Insurance is vacant. I was going to ask John, is there any information about when a commissioner might be appointed? Are there any rumblings? We've not heard anything.
No, I'm not hearing anything. I spoke with Deputy Commissioner for Financial Regulation, Jamie Walker. On that subject just last week. she gave me no updates or news, no names or anything like that. I think everyone's expectation is that at this point we'll continue as we are until we get through the legislative session. But other than that, I'm not hearing anything more specific on the commissioner.
Okay. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Quick update on moving to the association's offices. Office space build out and Heartland Plaza is underway. I was in there last week and walked through the space and talked to the construction manager on site. We have a walkthrough scheduled for Thursday to finalize the electrical punch out. A couple of inspections have already been done. Everything's on schedule. There have been one or two small wrinkles that have been identified as the demolition was happening. First, the existing wiring that was in place for IT, you know, the Ethernet cabling was not at code. So that had to be pulled and we put in new. And then one of the walls was not the dividing wall between our space and someone else's space. Did not go all the way to the ceiling. So the carryover of sound and other items was going to be an issue. Not required by fire code, but for security and I guess ease of operation, we did have a change order to carry that wall on up to the ceiling of the floor above. So that's underway. We have weekly meetings with the construction team. And as I said, everything's on track. We are scheduling a move on one of two Saturdays, either May 22nd or May 29th, with a significant preference toward May 22nd rather than the 29th, because the 29th is Memorial Day weekend. And Monday the 31st would be our last day under our lease at our other office. And we'd like to have a little bit of a buffer. So we're targeting May 22nd. The construction team and the management new office is aware of that. And we do think we're going to be able to hit that date. We have some other issues. We have a lot of furniture in the other office in where I'm sitting right now that we need to get rid of, that we will not be moving. And probably by mid-May, we will end up hiring someone to come and just haul it away. So if there's anyone that has a need for any office furniture, please contact me. I can give you a list of what we have. We also have our voice over IP phone system, including the Polycom conference phone and external microphones that we are not going to be using. I'm going to be listing those on Craigslist. They do have a little bit of value, but we've not been able to find a home for them yet. The review of the office files, the hard copy files, has been completed, and Topping is preparing for a significant destruction in accordance with their record retention policy. So that's going to be underway. And I think we're on track. Topping is getting proposals from moving companies, and she's got that in hand. She's in charge of it. She knows what she's doing. I'm just waiting for her to tell me what I need to do. So I think we're in pretty good place. I do want to report that there's one aspect of this that is gonna be a change that maybe you have not considered or thought about. Sorry, I hit the wrong button again. Wrong one, apologize, I have to go back here. There we go. Thought we were there. Move this out of the way. Okay. So as you're aware, this is our current logo. It's been the logo of the association since 1991. I didn't like it then. I don't like it now. It's the mirror image of the old Talhi Star. If you guys remember the Talhi Star when Mike Pollard was there.
Yes. New address, time to update the logo.
God, I hate this thing. Always have. We're going to have to replace letterhead. We're going to have to replace envelopes. We're going to have to replace business cards. If we're going to change the logo, now's the time. So Topping worked with a graphic designer and had probably, Topping a dozen different designs?
Yeah, that sounds right.
About a dozen. Of course, Topping and I have very different tastes. We think different things. And so she succumbed to my thought. So where we are leaning right now is to move to a different logo that would promote the acronym of the association. Not too parochial, but we like to put Texas on there. This is the logo we're leaning to now. We've got about three different versions of it, but I want to get your feel for this logo, and I'll put it side by side with the old and the new. Any thoughts?
That's fine. It looks to me, it's still maybe a little dated looking, but I'm not a brand logo person. I do think it's an improvement over the one we have. And I like emphasizing the abbreviation because I think it's less of a mouthful, and the more people get used to it, the better. And so Topping, I do like the abbreviation.
Topping is recommending and has versions of this. And she has a couple of other ones that are a little more modern, maybe along your thought line, Patty. But she has versions of this that just use the acronym and then also have the Texas with the name stretched out differently. So looking what would fit on the website, what would fit on a business card, what would fit best on letterhead. So there are different versions of the same design based on the usage.
Yeah. I would say one more comment that I have, and I'll be quiet and hear from other people, but I do think the full name should be on there just to be clear. And I don't, because we're not outselling a product or marketing, I'm not sure it matters. Stylist, I mean, as long as you're happy with it, I really don't care. But those are my thoughts. I do think it looks good, and it's better than the original one.
Okay. And Jim Lewis did get the benefit of seeing some of the other designs. I floated some of those past him on one of our status calls. Jim, your thoughts?
I think y'all probably addressed it. My only concern was if it was on a business card, would he be able to read Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association? But it sounds like you have different versions for different documents.
Okay, so be prepared. You may see something along these lines pretty soon. Going back to the rest of our meeting. Let me get to the right place. Sorry. Takes just a moment. I apologize. There are too many screens here. Okay. Remainder of my report on activities after the office space. We completed our migration to a cloud environment this past weekend and took a lot longer than we thought because of a couple of applications. Our image right management software for images and then the QL admin policy administration system. There are specific items that had to be addressed very carefully there to move them to a cloud environment. But we are now operating under Microsoft Azure. Our on-premises servers are still running, but they can be turned off at any time. So we're in kind of a mirrored process right now where we have both still running just in case something is not matching up, but everything seems to be working fine. So this is gonna make a substantial change in security and also ease of access. I have not lost sight that one of the things the board asked me to do is provide several members of the board with access to our network documentation because a lot of those things are referenced in our report on critical functions and processes. Now that we have that cloud environment, we will begin setting up that access. So it's coming. This was just the first stage in that process. With the COVID pandemic somewhat lessening and hoping that at some point this summer we'll get back in the offices, and with some of these other projects behind us, our policy procedure manual and business continuity plan will take center stage, and those are going to be updated by year end. Of course, the business continuity plan has a lot to do with the movement of the offices. Plus, we've had a lot of systems changes, not only the cloud, but also other applications have changed. So this will be a substantial rewrite of the business continuity plan and a wholesale reformatting of the policy and procedure manual. The NEIC meeting, John Alexander mentioned that earlier. It was just completed last week. This was the first meeting I haven't attended in years. I went through the agenda and only saw maybe one meeting that might have value, but based on the virtual meetings that the NEIC has held recently, I did not get much from those meetings, so I did not attend and decided not to spend the $495 registration fee. So hopefully the meetings will get back to in-person sometime soon because I think they're much more productive. There was a NOLGA MPC meeting held in January, and I'll go down to the schedule here. The next meetings of the MPC start tomorrow. I'm making a presentation, Patty, on the wellness program to the MPC. Jody and I are going to do some slides. And then I'm doing a presentation on the 22nd with Vince Bodner and Ralph Donato on kind of the new world of long-term care. Todd Thacker from California is going to moderate that. I think it's going to be done in somewhat of a Jeopardy format. So this is going to be different, but the information is going to be good. I've had a couple of calls with Ralph and Vince, and the information of what's happening in today's marketplace and what it might mean for Guaranty Association System is really kind of striking. And on the litigation, there's nothing really to update you there. So Jim, that's all of my executive director report, unless there are questions.
we will move on then to agenda item 9, consideration and possible action regarding the 2020 annual report.
So the annual report was distributed in the material to all the directors. I will mention one page, move to it here, page 4, and that is the list of directors as of December 31st, 2020. The page that was distributed included both Tom Munson and Wendy Karsten with information showing when during 2020 they stopped serving. And a concern was raised, and it was very appropriate. It's a little bit misleading that we say, here's the board of directors as of December 31st, 2020, and there's a list of 10 people. But two of those people as of December 31st were not serving. So we've made a revision to remove Tom Munson and Wendy Karsten off the list. This is just a snapshot of the directors serving as of December 31st. And you can see there are 8 directors and there's one small insurance company vacancy. So that is the only difference from the material that was included in your packet.
Have these been printed?
No.
I guess I'll tell you that I didn't catch it. I'm Dallas, Texas. We moved in 2019.
Stopping.
I will change that.
Duly noted, will be changed. The version that you have, any changes that come out right now will be implemented. We print it and submit it to the Commissioner of Insurance and then send it to the printers for the bound versions to be printed. Jacqueline, when we have on here small insurance company vacancy, should that be small insurer member? I'm just thinking the difference between insurance companies and HMOs.
Yes, I would change that to member.
So small member, small, it should be insurance company / HMO or just small member?
I don't think, well, you could say small insurance company member. Or just small member company vacancy.
Let's do that. Topping small member company vacancy.
Okay, will do.
Just technically, HMOs are not insurance companies. So. And did anyone have any other comments or questions about the annual report? And you probably noticed that it was somewhat light this year. There are just not a lot of receiverships to talk about. That will probably change. The next year will look different. Okay, Jim, with no comments, there is a resolution here on 921 for your consideration.
Jim Harrison, so moved.
Robin Vincent, second.
Discussion? Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hey, so can I ask something about it?
Yes.
Is that something that's required by statute or bylaw for us to do? And does it have to be printed, I guess, is what I'm asking, because it seems like it's 2021. It could be a PDF easily, but not if the law requires it.
The only thing required by statute is that we submit the report to the Commissioner of Insurance by April 30th. And I think the report actually says, I know it's definitely of the, I'm going to get to the exact language, financial condition of the association.
I just know that even the Department of Insurance is making a big digital push. I'm not saying we shouldn't publish it, but on paper, but.
Here we go. Statute says not later than 120th day after the last day of each association's fiscal year, the board shall submit to the commissioner a financial report in a form approved by the commissioner and a report of the association's activities during the preceding fiscal year. So our annual report with the audited financial statements included is required to be submitted by to the commissioner, nothing beyond that. So
since didn't 19- know if they'd even prefer to have it in PDF format. I don't know. Maybe not.
We could post it on the association's website and not print it and not distribute it. It is up to the board.
I think another option, Bart, you would have is that you could distribute it to certain, places, people like the insurance commissioner, and I don't know who else you typically, would send it to, and then also post it on the website.
I think for the most important people that we include in this, we do send governor's office, lieutenant governor's office, House Insurance Committee chair of the state affairs and Senate. So there are some legislative, there's a handful there we submit it to. The others are really sent to all the other Guaranty associations. So it's roughly ends up being about 80 copies that we have printed. We roughly do 100 a year. And then if we're requested any, we just can drop one in the mail. But there's no requirement.
I only ask because, we used to print, 50 copies of our blue book for our annual financial statement. And we're not even doing that anymore because it's getting distributed to everyone by PDF. There are a few states that still want a blue book, but not many. I'm not saying we shouldn't print them. It's just.
And the PDFs are on the website of the last 5 years of annual reports.
Yeah. This is James. Why don't we, James Kennedy? I'm sorry. It's when you have two board members, one with my first name and one with my last name. I guess I need to be more specific, right? Why don't we go back and see if there's any preference within TDI on this? Because we are getting away from paper, and there's a desire to have as little as possible at this point.
I know I'd rather have an electronic version than the one you send me, but.
James, if you could let us know by April 30th.
Okay.
And then we will follow those instructions for submission to the commissioner.
All right.
Deputy commissioner. Is it Deputy Doug? I don't know.
Chief Deputy.
Chief Deputy Doug.
Chief Deputy, yeah.
Okay, and as far as printing and distributing to the other parties, would the board prefer that we forego that cost this year? And it's about $1,800, $2,000 to print, and then the mailing. Is that approximately right, Topping?
It's about $1,100 to print,
okay,
plus mailing. Because the quote went down this year.
Oh.
This is Ted. My inclination, unless you hear from TDI a preference otherwise, would be to go solely electronic for all other distribution, including TDI, if they're amenable.
Okay. With that direction, that is the way we will go. Thank you. And Jim, thanks for raising that.
Sure. Okay, sorry. That brings us to item number 10 with estate summary, stuff that we have to do.
Let me just mention a couple of insolvencies here, but I won't go into a lot of detail because the volume is down, but I think it is important. I won't go over the active estate list and what we've paid. I mean, the volume of direct payments is small. Where the association staff is chewing up time right now is on a couple of insolvencies. Calanthe Mutual, we have had a high level of phone calls, cash surrender requests, death claims. When the special deputy receiver was receiving 8 to 10 a month, that's not the case. Since October, you can see the volume on the schedule here. We've had 69 surrenders and 12 death claims and a lot of calls. And some of these death claims and surrenders require an unusual amount of work because the records of Calanthe are not very thorough. We don't have beneficiary designations, and we have to do a lot of research, and then there's additional documentation we have to obtain to try to avoid disputes later after we distribute benefit payments. So Tobing and Jarrett have been doing a lot of work on this, and it's finally starting to turn a corner and slow down, but it has been requiring a lot of time. So Calanthe is one. Penn Treaty is where I'm still spending a lot of my time. It took all this weekend to work through the most recent quarterly report from PACA. This was the quarter where the conversion from the legacy Penn Treaty administration platform to the TriPlus CAPS administration platform was completed. The long-term care business for Penn Treaty was converted as of March 1st. And as of April 1st, the non-long-term care Penn Treaty and ANIC business was converted. And there were some issues. As you would think, when you've got that many records, there were just metrics being captured with data feeds that didn't match up. And so we had a hard time reconciling a lot of the numbers, but I think we have them all resolved now. So I spent the weekend doing a lot of explanations and reconciliations of reports. But I think the conversion is going to be good. And as we move forward, we're going to see a significant improvement. One thing that was of issue in the administration in this most recent quarter, TriPlus did miss one of their quarterly service level standards. They were proactive on this and alerted us in February that they were concerned about some call center issues that were coming up. It was kind of a perfect storm. They were getting a lot of phone calls, and a lot of them maybe things that you in the industry may be getting in your companies. Call centers are getting inundated with calls on delays in billing statements, delays in benefit payments. Anything that's being distributed by the Postal Service is a problem right now. It's a huge problem. I have it several other insolvencies that I work on, and we're seeing it in our insolvencies we are dealing with in-house. So that level of calls, plus the call center reps converting over to the new administration platform and just taking longer to find which screens to go to answer questions, and a couple of vacancies in the call center. So with some additional hires, some cross training, and more intensive training, TriPlus has submitted a remediation plan and already begun to implement it. It was not a huge problem that they missed the service level standard. It had to do with the, actually they were close on abandonment rate, but I think it was the time to answer what the percentage of calls had to be answered within 1 minute. And the call periods on hold, calls were taking longer, so we're having people on hold longer. I think it's been addressed, but that's the type of monitoring we do on this block to make sure that they meet all 24 of their service level standards. In addition to that, Patty and I both work on a wellness committee that is evaluating various wellness vendors for possible implementation. That started out with, we were looking at 24 different vendors. We got proposals from 14. This has been weeded down to right now, we've got 5 potential, and we're doing some final pencil sharpening on those. The group that's involved in this wellness committee that Patty and I serve on, we've been meeting weekly since September on this. And wellness is a beneficial approach because I think it's a win-win, especially if we monitor it, right? That the policyholder is going to have an enhanced quality of life, be able to age in place in their homes. And with that, not only will they be more comfortable, but their family members and family caregivers will have some comfort and won't be as concerned. But then the side product of this will be a reduction in utilization of the benefits under their policies. They either prolong the time when they utilize those benefits, or the amount of benefits they need will be less or at a lesser level, maybe more home health care rather than going into facility for those that have comprehensive coverage. So the cost here should be de minimis compared to the potential savings. LTC Re has budgeted to implement wellness in 2021. So the committee will be making a proposal to the LTC Re Board of Directors, and I believe they're supposed to meet May 12th or 13th. Patty, you probably know you're on the board.
I think it's 12th.
12th. And we're hopeful that with that, we can move forward with a couple of these vendors. The programs will be implemented as pilot programs, okay, with kind of a sample selection of policy holders. And these are going to be based really on, it may be a group of policyholders that are not on claim, some that are on claim. It may be tax qualified, non-tax qualified. For some vendors, it may just be a certain age group. So it will be a selection, not the entire universe of the PIN treaty policyholders that will be offered the opportunity to participate in a pilot program. I say offered because it'll be a voluntary program. No policyholders required to participate. Should they participate, they are involved with no cost to them. The cost is paid by LTC Re as part of its operating cost. The programs will run, and honestly, as I said, we're looking at five. I'm really leaning toward, I think there's two we should implement. But let's say we do implement two. They'll be evaluated over a 12 to 24 month period to see what are the benefits. Have the policyholders and consumers really received significant benefits here? With the participants in the group compared to a similar control group, what has been the comparative of their claims? So has there been a claim savings? It's not a reduction in claim, it's an avoidance of claim. So after that 12 or 24 month period, we will look at should these programs be continued or discontinued, should they be expanded? So this wellness initiative is an approach that's been used to manage care and has now been expanding into long-term care. Almost all of the leading long-term care companies in the country are using wellness. None of the programs being evaluated by this committee for adoption are new programs that have not been tried in any market. All of these have been used by other companies, and we've talked with those companies. So the Guaranty Associations are not guinea pigs. We're using programs that have had some track record of success. The key will be how do they fit to our PIN treaty block. So wellness is going to be a big program for this coming year, and it should kick off this summer. So Patty, anything you want to throw in on wellness?
I think I would just add that it's been a pretty tremendous amount of work and effort. And as always, Bart, this A+ in terms of reviewing all the materials in advance and contributing. On the plus side, I will say just from a general perspective that these kinds of programs, if they continue to take off, are good for people. It's like the old indemnity days versus managed care. I mean, they don't have to participate. It's voluntary. Nobody forces them to do anything, but they get information and help that's supportive for them and really, you know, benefits the entity in that you save on claims. But almost more importantly, if you can help someone to stay in their home for little minor things that they didn't even realize they should be considering. Like one of the things they mentioned on one of the calls was like those taller toilet seats and other things that they can help the family do that could mean the difference between a broken hip and spend the rest of your life in a nursing home and being able to be at home. It's just kind of an amazing thing. So I've enjoyed being on this subcommittee, and I just want to commend Bart for his, you know, A+ effort as always.
Well, thank you, Patty. You know, you may not think much about it, but grab bars in some consumers' homes save so much pain and suffering and ultimately claims costs. Then we have a lot of these of our claimants that they have family caregivers. And family caregivers, that's a tough life. You may start out as a daughter, 90% daughter and 10% caregiver. And over time, you become 10% daughter and 90% caregiver. And that's really not good for the relationship. So some of the programs offer support for that family caregiver and opportunities to prevent burnout. So I'm not doing it justice because these are very broad. The intervention techniques are very broad in these wellness programs, but they're all advantageous. And to finish up Penn Treaty, my group, the Policy and Claims Administration Working Group, PACA, we call it, is going to be working on some revisions with the TPA on how assessments are ordered and utilized. Historically, in long-term care, face-to-face assessments were the nature of the business. Well, when COVID came along, face-to-face assessments shut down. They were not conducted. Vendors would not provide them. We did transcend to telephonic assessments for this block during COVID, but they're inadequate. And so now virtual assessments have been developed. So we are going to work through the assessment ordering guidelines with the TPA to use all three, face-to-face, virtual, and telephonic. They are used for different purposes, provide different levels of information, and at different costs. So we're really kind of enhancing our administration. Then electronic visit verification will be picked up, and we're evaluating several EVV vendors to help prevent fraud, waste, and abuse with home health care claims. This is very, very important. We had a program in place in Penn Treaty. I was not a big fan of the program and had limited success. We're going to do better this next time. And then there's some additional measures on potential fraud, waste, and abuse prevention, which on a block like this can be a problem, and it does add up. So that's roughly Penn Treaty. Lincoln Memorial Service, we only have a handful of policies there. I will report that the SDR did receive $14,360,574.99 from the New York Liquidation Bureau. And this was when the PLICA, the Professional Liability Insurance Company of America, the New York Medical Malpractice Receivership, was finally liquidated. Lincoln Memorial, as its parent, received this distribution. And the SDR joined. Howard was very diligent pursuing this claim, and it produced $14 million, of which probably $14 million roughly, or 13 and a half, will come to the guarantee associations. And with that, all we're waiting on in Lincoln Memorial is a decision on our appeal in the Eighth Circuit. Universal Life, this is a company that is probably going to relegate to not being reported in future meetings. We're just continuing to run off claims as they occur. It's going to be a many-year runoff, and this is the one I mentioned has just terrible records. And then Northwestern National, Jarrett continues to administer one policy in-house, and Topping is involved too because he has to speak with the providers and the claimant occasionally when he calls. But this gentleman, we will continue to run off his policy and pay his claims, collect his premiums into the future. And that was all to report on those insolvencies. Jim?
Okay, that's it for item 10. We'll move on to item 11. By the way, I don't know if this is related to corporate governance, but I just got my Texas Ethics Commission PFS thing in the mail yesterday. I'm assuming other people will be getting them soon if you haven't gotten it already. The reason it's late this year is because they pushed the deadline back to June 30th. But I, like I said, I just got mine in the mail yesterday. So,
yeah, and I sent an email to all the board with that notice that I found on the Ethics Commission website about, and it did say in response to the IRS extending their deadline for filing returns this year, they were going to extend their deadline to June 30th. So your personal financial statements are not due until June 30th. If you have any questions, I can put you in contact with the right person at the Ethics Commission, but don't send them to me. They go to the Ethics Commission. But if you need any help or assistance, let me know. The other items are annual conflicts of interest, business ethics questionnaires, and our antitrust certifications. Those were distributed. We have four outstanding that I'm still trying to follow up on. But on all the others, from employees, directors, and vendors, there have been no issues mentioned that require follow-up. They have been extremely clean this year, and I've reviewed all of them. So there have not been any concerns raised whatsoever. The final four I'll continue to chase down, and I'll wrap that up at the next meeting. And Jim, I have nothing else in corporate governance.
Then I guess we're on to item number 12, the assessments.
Okay. As was reported in January to the board, we still had some issues with data to resolve the 2020 Class A assessment. We had some HMO members that had challenged the calculation of the assessments as having included chip premium. And after research, we did identify that the companies that had challenged us had definitely had chip premium included, and we adjusted and refunded their assessments. But to be consistent, we were directed by the board, and we made an extensive presentation and had a thorough discussion with the Assessment Investment Committee in January. But we were directed to follow up and research those additional HMOs to see if they also had chip premiums. So we worked with TDI, and we went through a lot of additional annual statement information. I know Jim Harrison and Jim Lewis both got extensive emails from me about this. Shelby and I had a conversation about some of the data, and we were able to consistently identify through the same methodology and the same annual statement documentation for those companies that there were nine companies that had, was it nine, Jarrett, is that correct?
Yes, it was nine other companies.
Yeah, nine additional companies that had chip premium, and we were calculated and processed refunds of that 2020 Class A assessment to those companies. And the total of refunds were $13,849. So with that, the 2020 Class A assessment was completely finalized and is now closed. Moving on to the 2020. Oh, yes.
It was originally nine, but then after we talked with board counsel about what the source of the data that we should use should be, we went down to
seven,
and the actual refund was $12,121.46.
You're right. I flipped the page and missed the note there with the correction. You're right. There were only seven companies. And you have to remember, these seven companies did not raise this issue with us. They weren't complaining. It was the association was proactive to identify this and refunded it to those companies. All right, the 2021 Class A assessment. This was $1 million assessment for administrative expenses that the board authorized in its January 26th meeting. Some of the same assessable premium research that was done to correct the March 2020 assessment was done prior to this assessment being calculated and distributed. So Jarrett did all that work. It was calculated, printed, and distributed on March 12th. Jarrett, do you want to summarize any of those numbers about what went out the door?
Yeah, so the after adjustment for, we don't send out notifications for invoices that are $5 or less. So after we take those out, the total was the $999,947.27. Of that, $875,255.97 is due, new money is due in. And then the rest of that, the $124,000 is collected from the credit balances for companies that have a credit balance. You can see down there after we've done that, then the credit balance payable to the remaining companies is now $3,956,990.41. We have a breakdown of how the invoices worked out. Since it was a small assessment, there's not a lot of big dollar numbers, except for the one largest insurer is $178,000. Let's see. I have an updated amount on how much has been collected. So as of yesterday, we have collected $419,523.38 from 220 members, and that is from the $875,255.97 due.
And Jarrett, we should mention that the good news there is almost all those payments have been done by electronic funds transfer.
Yes.
We are pushing really hard to get away from hard copy checks. So we've come a long way. There is one company that is in rehabilitation, Time Insurance Company, and they had requested a deferral of their 2020 Class A assessment, and it was granted. Their assessment in 2021 is $708.08, and they have again requested deferral of that assessment. So we are recommending that, and we can either, Jim, address it now or go ahead and go through the financial statements and address it then.
Whichever you prefer.
Let's go ahead and take care of it now if we could.
Do you need a motion?
Yes, please.
I move.
Jim Harrison seconds.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Thank you very much.
Okay. We have a little bit to show you on the financial statements. There's been some movements and some numbers, and you will see into the month ending January 31st, 2021. Jarrett has calculated some approximate values for the implementation of GASB 87. Of course, those can change as we implement the consulting agreement and arrangement that you authorized earlier in today's meeting. But I think it is important to have Jarrett kind of point out where these new line items appear on the financials. So Jarrett, you want to point to some of these?
Yes. So if you'll look kind of in the middle of the page under capital assets, excuse me, you'll see a new account there called right of use lease assets. And that's one of the accounts that's required by GASB 87. It is a small dollar amount right now because the only leases that we have calculated are the 5 months that's left in this year on our old lease and our postage machine. Beginning June 1st, that number will go up significantly because we will calculate the present value of the brand new lease, all 7 years of it. So that number will change significantly. And then if we have any new discount rates provided by the engagement from Clifton Larson Allen. If you'll scroll on down to the, towards the bottom of the page, the last number there, you see the GASB 87 lease liability. Once again, that's a small number because of the same reason. It's decreasing based upon the amortization of the lease payments, whereas the lease asset will stay the same. However, the accumulated depreciation will go up and offset that lease asset based upon the depreciation of the lease payments. On the next page, you see the line item there for depreciation. Normally it's around $760. We see a significant increase in that because of those lease payments are now being depreciated rather than expensed. And so therefore you'll also see a decrease in the line above that for the building and equipment leases, because those lease payments are not expensed anymore. And then finally, on the statement of cash flows, down at the bottom, there's a new line item there for capital lease payments, because of the same reason, they are now depreciated and amortized rather than expensed. And so they now go into the investing activities rather than where they were included as an expense up in the operating activities. And that's all I have really on the implementation of GASB 87, unless there's any questions.
So as you can see, you know, the line items themselves, there's really no mystery to that. Where the Clifton Larson Allen engagement is going to assist is actually in the value calculation themselves, and then probably some footnote disclosures. Any questions in that, or any other questions on the financials or the notes to the financials that were distributed?
I do have a question for the board, if they like the presentation on the financial statements with the little notes on the different things that we wanted to discuss during the financial statements, or do you find it too busy?
I like the notes. I think it's, and when you look at a big page full of a whole bunch of numbers, for you to be able to point to the exact number that we're discussing, I think is very helpful.
Ditto.
Agreed.
Okay, well then I will continue doing that.
Very good. So Jim, that's all we had in the financials.
Calendar of activities. Item 13.
Okay, so the calendar of activities is attached, and it is the same as you've seen. We update it quarterly. We'll update it again after this meeting, but nothing unusual there. But you should look at that calendar, because it does have the dates of when we have specific meetings scheduled. The next meeting that was tentatively scheduled for the board will be July 20th, Tuesday, July 20th. We are still planning on that meeting to be a virtual meeting. We think it's a little too early to anticipate what might be happening in the COVID pandemic. So we're going to schedule this meeting as a virtual meeting. We will discuss at that time plans for October. That may be a meeting that can be held in person and also virtual, or with telephonically for those that can't attend in person. So we will talk about that in July, but we're planning the same process for the next meeting.
Well, does anybody have anything else? Anybody have a problem with July 20th?
Mr. Chairman, it's Ted. I do have a conflict today. It's likely to change. We've had a family vacation cruise canceled three times now due to COVID. It's rescheduled, and I might be able to make virtually the 20th. We will be flying back from Europe on the 19th. I'm not sure our arrival on the 20th, but they just announced the State Department's going to restrict travel to 80% of the countries this summer. If that happens, the cruise will likely be canceled, so it won't be a problem. But as of today, I do have a conflict.
I may have a conflict too, Bart, but I'll double check and get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else, let me know. We have plenty of time. If we need to move this meeting date and poll for another, but this is the first target. So don't hesitate to let me know if a conflict arises.
Bart, I know NOLGA is the 22nd, but just for me personally, the 21st is wide open.
Okay. Yeah, and that will be NOLGA's MPC and legal seminar. And it is planned right now of remaining virtual, but the tentative plans for October NOLGA meeting is going to be in person. And Jim, that is all we have for today.
Okay, well, if nobody has anything else, I'll adjourn the meeting. Time is 11:22 on April 20th, 2021, and this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association that has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for your